From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, two authors who found inspiration by observing life and death on the gritty streets of New York City. Edward Conlon is a New York detective who clocked time on the city's narcotics unit. His book, Blue Blood, now out in paperback, reveals a lot about the people he met on the beat and how he and his fellow officers interacted with them. Then, Robert Sullivan discusses his book, Rats, observations on the history and habitat of the city's most unwanted inhabitants. All he had to do was set up shop at one end of an alley near Wall Street and sit and watch. And David Edelstein reviews Sin City, based on the graphic novels by Frank Miller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Edward Conlon writes about what it's like to be a New York City cop in his memoir, Blue Blood, which has just come out in paperback. He joined the NYPD 10 years ago and has patrolled housing projects and worked in the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. He is now a detective in the Bronx. He reflects on crime, danger, and death with the skill of a fine novelist. The best-selling crime writer Ed McBain described Blue Blood as a splendid recounting of Conlon's long years with the NYPD, a book that resonates with the shattering ring of truth and reads surprisingly like a novel. Conlon first wrote about his work in a series of autobiographical pieces for The New Yorker, published under a pseudonym. Terry spoke with Conlon last year when Blue Blood was first published. Let's start with a short reading from that book.
When you arrest someone, it's like a blind date. You spend a few hours with a stranger, a few feet apart, saying, "Tell me about yourself." You ask, "How much do you weigh?" And, "Are you a gang member?" "Really? Which one?" So maybe I haven't been on a blind date for a while. But you do hold hands for a few minutes as you take prints, rolling each fingertip individually, then four fingers together, flat, and the thumb flat at the bottom of the card. Three cards for adults, four for juveniles. You coat a plastic plank lightly with ink, rolling it from a pad, then take each finger, relax, and roll it on the plank and then on the card. A lot of people try to help you, rolling the fingers themselves, which usually smudges the impression. Sometimes that's their intent. Crackheads often don't have usable prints, with fingers burnt smooth from gripping the red-hot glass pipe. Junkies coming down can go into a whole body cramp and have hands as stiff as lobster claws. Perps collared for robbery or assault might have bruised, swollen, and bloody fingers. You try to be gentle, and you wear latex gloves.
That's Edward Conlon reading from his new memoir, Blue Blood, about his life as an officer on the NYPD. You know, it sounds like there's a surprising intimacy with the people that you arrest. Do you feel that way usually?
Well, sometimes you spend a lot of time with them, and if it goes right, you spend even more time. I mean, every time you arrest someone, you're going to spend hours in the cell and hours bringing them down and hours after that talking to them to try and get them to talk about what they did and what else they might know about what other people are doing. So you try and be closer to them sometimes than it's in their best interest.
You usually also see people at their worst, at their most violent or their most vulnerable. In fact, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the elderly woman who you walked in on a call, and she was basically, she was alive, but she was decomposing in her own bed.
Yeah, that was really just about the most terrible thing that I've seen. There was an aided case, which is a medical call. We would escort EMS into the projects when they came. It was called an aided case. And in this one, I wasn't sure what the original call was. I was just one of the officers who went along with the ambulance. And we went in, and it was this big apartment. It was a housing project, but I think it was a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment. So it just had a huge feel to it. You were walking down the halls in this room after room after room. And finally, when we got to the last bedroom, there was what we know as the DOA smell, the smell of a dying body. And the EMS was already there, and a couple of the paramedics were around the body, and they were crying, which was not something you usually see, because, you know, these are people who see bodies in pieces and dead babies, really, as a matter of course. So this had to be something exceptional. And it was. In this case, there was this old woman who was on a bed, and it was just a plastic sheet, kind of bare. And she was emaciated. I mean, she was once a kind of heavy woman, but she was really just looked deflated, the way the skin hung on her. And so they were lifting her off that plastic sheet, and then she started to moan. And it was, there were maggots all over her, and maggots only eat dead tissue. So this woman literally was dying bit by bit. And she'd been left there. And the terrible, really terrible thing was that she didn't live alone. She had a granddaughter, I believe, and also her daughter, who were in and out. And it was the granddaughter who had called the cops. And we weren't maybe as polite as we might have been, because she was just took this kind of pouty teenager tone. And said, "Well, why didn't you call the cop? Why didn't you call the ambulance?" And she said, "Well, I'm the one who did. So why didn't you give her anything to eat?" She said she wasn't hungry. Well, why didn't you call an ambulance before then? Oh, my mother said not to. And this family had kept her there because the checks went through her. She got all kinds of subsidies for the apartment, for the grandkids, for everybody. She was where the money came from. So they held on to her as long as they could.
What does it do to you to always see people at their worst?
Well, people don't call the cops when they're happy. That's sort of the fact of the job. So it can skew your perspective a little bit because something terrible has usually happened, whether it's your house has been broken into or a relative has died. You just see pretty much the worst all the time when you're responding to a job. And that's actually why I liked walking a beat so much, especially earlier in the career, because you got to see the ordinary life and the better parts of people's lives. Just walking around and people would say hello and they were happy to see you most of the time.
After working as a beat cop, you worked for the Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. What was the job?
That was to catch drug dealers. We through what's called observation sales. We would go to a rooftop or into an apartment and look out the window and watch the corner, watch the lobby or wherever they were selling. It was pretty much crack and heroin in the South Bronx at the time. And it was interesting work. You'd have somebody in the observation post or OP, and you would just watch to see what happened. I mean, we knew most people. We knew most of the places. And you would see the guys in the corner, and somebody would come up and buy, and you'd tell somebody in the catch car to go pick them up a couple blocks away. And it was the other way the police department does it, though that kind of operations, is called buy and bust, where an undercover makes a buy and people swoop in afterwards and pick up the dealer. But this was more, we didn't have undercovers in the precinct level, and this is more amateur in a way and interesting in another way, because you saw everything. You just got to see how the whole set worked, and it was almost like a nature show, you know, in the felony ecology of the streets. You would see who was the lookout and who was the manager, and, you know, if this crackhead came up, and they might have a guy on a bicycle, follow him for a block or two to see if we were watching. And it was sometimes you felt like you were, you know, the boss of the casino, watching all the tables to see whose luck was too good and which guy was standing there purposely and which guy was making a move and which guy is a guy you should keep on watching.
You write that in some ways the cop code and the criminal code reflect each other in a funhouse mirror, and you're talking there in part about what respect means to the cop and to the criminal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, respect, I mean, they do resemble each other in a certain way, but I really don't know what respect means sometimes in out in the street in the ghetto. I mean, there was one drug dealer when I was a beat cop. I locked him up once or twice, but I'd see him out there and I'd nod to him, and just to show that I saw him there. But he used to tell me, you know, you're all right now, you're all right, Conlon, you respect me, which was just not true. I didn't respect him, but I mean, I treated him fairly, and I didn't arrest him when he didn't have drugs. But I mean, that if that was his idea of respect, well, so it goes. But sometimes it means a lot less. It just means that you're not attacking me on sight whenever you feel like it. You know, that's not my idea of respect. But cops, especially when they're out in the street, when they are walking alone, walking beats, they do have to make sure that it's understood that people won't even begin to try that. I mean, that people won't jump them, that people won't come after them. So in that sense, a sense of respect, of keeping your distance because you know you're going to get worse than what you give, that has to be communicated.
How hard was it for you to get respect from people on the street?
I don't know. I mean, I was there for a couple of years, so people got to know me.
You talking about the housing project now?
Yeah. And also, I mean, I was 30 years old when I started, so, I mean, I wasn't a kid, really, so I didn't really have much of a chip on my shoulder. I'd talk to people and say hello and walk by, and But, you know, you do get into these confrontations, especially if there's a group of guys. And that was the kind of classic and exhausting part about of antagonism of the beat. You walk by a couple of guys who may be drinking beers or maybe playing the radio. And you walk by and say, listen, guys, you got to keep it down. We've had complaints. And maybe you have and maybe you haven't. But, you know, you will if they keep going. So it's just sort of a test to see if they're going to respect you, because you've given them some respect. You've talked to them nicely and asked them for some accommodation, but not to break up the party completely. And you'll see how that goes. And maybe they will, and maybe they'll keep it down. And they say, all right, well, thanks, take care. Or usually, very often, somebody will mouth off, you know, F you, what are you going to do about it? And then that's where the respect comes in. You've got to turn around and talk to them. And maybe they'll back down again and say they're sorry, and maybe the guys will jump in and say, don't mind him, he's a little drunk. As long as there's a reaction that shows respect, then, you know, you can say, okay, guys, take it easy, and move along.
Edward Conlon speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with author and New York City detective Edward Conlon.
Part of your memoir deals with what you did after September 11th, and you were assigned to go to the Fresh Kills landfill, where all the remains were sent, and just to be one of the people sifting through the remains, looking for bones, body parts, and personal possessions in the dust and rubble. I'd like you to read a short excerpt from that chapter.
There was everything there and nothing. The dirt wasn't even dirt, not earth, but a blend of ash and dust. Concrete walls, wooden desks, the people who sat behind them, broken, burnt, and hosed down. The largest pieces of structural steel were deposited off to the side, but 20-foot sections of I-beams and concrete boulders the size of cars arrived on the trucks. There were little things that had survived and big things that hadn't. And there was a sense of the miraculous and the what, the counter-miraculous? The steel head of a hammer seemed to be attached to a head of human hair, wavy, greasy, and gray, fanning out like an old-fashioned feather duster. What was this? I lifted it to show the mutant next to me, in the practiced pantomime of the deafening silent piles. Shoulder shrug. What? Pointing. This? It was a freakish crossbreed, half hammer, half wig. The goggle man lifted his mask to yell, fiberglass handle, heat on fiberglass handle. There was a lot of bones. There were yards and yards of fire hose. There was white metal from the hulls of the planes. There was a Toyota mashed flat. A lot of single shoes. There were all kinds of documents, some in perfect condition, from Cantor Fitzgerald, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aon. I found the personnel file for an Irish Williams with a reprimand for being late in June 1992. I hoped Irish Williams was late on September 11th.
How long did you do this work, sifting through the rubble?
Well, we were there from September, I think, through February or March. March is when it closed down, I think. I think it was through February.
What was the hardest part of day after day, going to the landfill and looking for bones and remains?
No, I don't think there was so many parts that weren't hard. It was just an unreal scene, especially at first, where we'd work 12-hour tours. We'd either get there at dusk or at dawn, so you had these brilliant sunsets or sunrises. And Fresh Kills is this kind of man-made garbage mountain, this plateau that overlooks New York Harbor and Ground Zero, as it was just starting to be known then, and it was still burning. So it would be dusk, and you'd be on this trash mountain, and you'd look at the harbor, and you'd look at Statue of Liberty, and you'd look at the remains of the World Trade Center burning, and F-16s would be going through the sky, and it was it was always kind of windy there, and either this kind of gray dust always was whipped through, and you're in these Tyvek suits, these white cloths, these white suits and hard hats and goggles and masks. So we were all sort of looked like aliens and looking at this very alien scene. And then you would just grab a rake and move through the piles for 12 hours with these 5-gallon buckets next to you. And you would pick out something that looked like bone and you'd throw it in, or you might find a credit card, or you might find personnel files from, you know, Cantor Fitzgerald or any of these companies that were there, that just were, you just knew this was ordinary life for a few weeks before.
How did you end up being assigned to this work?
Because it was a crime scene. What in Fresh Kills, all the rubble from Ground Zero was trucked out and deposited to be examined for primarily body parts, but also what other identifiables we called them. Initially, they talked about hoping to find the black box, but you stopped hearing about that after a while. And this was a crime scene, and detectives are in charge of a crime scene.
You are one of several people in your family who became cops. Your great-grandfather was a cop. You have at least one uncle who was a cop. Your father was an FBI agent. Why do you think it's the kind of job that sometimes runs in families, that generations do it?
Well, an easy guess might be that fathers come home and tell stories about work, and they're certainly, I'm guessing they're better stories than, you know, from the accounting firm. I certainly grew up on cop stories, even though my father wouldn't have wanted me to become a cop. And with my great-grandfather, that was more interesting because he had, by his own choice, sort of cut off that, you know, family pipeline. He'd left my great-grandmother, and that's why he was more of a villain in the family lore than the fact that he was pretty definitely not the most honest cop in the world. I mean, when he retired, he went to run a horse room in Jersey, so he was obviously not unfamiliar with the sporting life.
Let me ask you something about your father. You had actually asked for your family's Freedom of Information Act files, and your father, who worked for the FBI, had a pretty thick file. I think it was from that file that you learned that he was actually in a car accident and killed a woman. Something.
Yeah, he did.
It was an accident, but
yeah.
But he never mentioned that to you.
He never did. And that was certainly the most surprising thing in the files, that he he had run a woman over in the early 1960s in a completely innocent accident from all appearances, but also a truly horrifying thing. I from the reports, is that he was driving up Broadway at, I believe, 256th Street, which is right near where I live, and a corner I've passed many, many times without thinking about it, and now I pass thinking about it, where he was driving up the street and an elderly couple was crossing, and a car speeding in the opposite direction made the woman jump back into the path of his car. And, it was what was done was done. It was all reported and investigated. And but I asked my mother about it, and she said that he said it was just the most horrible thing. He didn't believe it was happening as it was happening. And I was interested in it just because, well, for a number of reasons. One, because it had been hidden from me. But my father was a Marine in the Second World War, and then he was a G-man for almost 30 years. And he had never killed anybody and never hurt anybody, as far as I knew. And these are the most exciting and dangerous-seeming jobs you could imagine. And yet he runs somebody over going home from work someday. And it just seemed odd and sad that it had happened.
Why do you think he never told you?
I don't know. I mean, if it was nothing to be ashamed of, and I have no reason to believe it is, I don't know why it wouldn't have found its way into some cautionary tale about driving safety. You know, I didn't drive at the time. I didn't get a license till I became a cop. So there was maybe no opportunity for it. I think he just felt terribly about it.
Let me ask you about your writing. I just want to say I think you really write terrifically. Do you want to have more of a writer's life than a cop's life in the near future?
Well, one of the nice things about working full-time as a cop was that the time that I got to write was really a privilege I had to fight for. I mean, I wasn't sitting home all day wondering how I'm going to fill this page. It was, thank God, I've got a free hour. I've got a free afternoon. Let me get to it. So you could think of work as the big procrastination from writing. Or you
know. It's a lot of effort to procrastinate from writing.
Yeah.
So you're worried what would happen if you gave up the work and you're just facing the blank page?
Yeah. I mean, I like getting out a little bit every day.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Conlin speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His book, Blue Blood, has just been published in paperback. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Animal Crackers, Hannah Tinty's debut story collection that explores human fears and longings. And from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you were in New York, Robert Sullivan says, you are within close proximity to one or more rats having sex. Coming up, we'll hear from Sullivan. He's written a book about those dangerous, repulsive, and randy rodents. Also, another sort of Sin City. David Edelstein reviews that new film. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Rats command a perverse celebrity status. Nature's mobsters, flora and fauna's serial killers, writes Robert Sullivan in his nonfiction book Rats, which has just been published in paperback. Rats breed in filth and they carry disease. They multiply so quickly, they're like a plague. In fact, they spread the plague, the Black Death of the Middle Ages. Centuries later, they're still all around us, even when they're hiding out of sight. It wasn't difficult for Robert Sullivan to find a colony of rats to study. He chose a trash-filled alley just a block or two from Wall Street and what used to be the World Trade Center. He waited night after night to watch the rats come out and feed. After also traveling with exterminators and doing historical research, he wrote his book, Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. He's also the author of The Meadowlands and A Whale Hunt, and has written for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Terry spoke with Robert Sullivan last year and began with a short reading from his rat journal, describing one evening in his rat alley.
6:50. Out across Fulton Street, the garbage from the Burger King is dragged out, as I imagine is happening at fast food restaurants all over New York and around this time. A small mountain of garbage bags forms, a vile and grease-dripping, sedimentary New York City occurrence that nightly turns the streets into miniature badlands to be eroded by morning, assuming the sanitation workers arrive, after which there will be dark stains on the concrete, like sweat on the morning rocks of a mountain. 6:57. More garbage, more rats. So many more that it's becoming difficult to concentrate. There are too many rats now, more than a dozen visible at any time, squads constantly surfacing, resurfacing. In the foreground are the young rats. In the back, the larger rats, the rats that must be older, given their size. When I venture up with binoculars, I can see their mottled coats, the bite marks. On one, a gash-like scar. I see also specialty diversions, rat performers in a circus of trash, affording much entertainment for the alley watcher. A rat climbs up a garbage bag, stops at the summit, appears to look around. The rat jumps nearly straight up, in fact, jumps for what my later measurements will show to be 1 foot, up, up, and onto the old ledge of a boarded-up window. The rat walks along the ledge and turns behind the rusted old steel window bars to face the alley again, then lowers himself down onto a bag back close to the wall, a bag that is inaccessible from the alley floor. 7:15. The rats are drunk on food, I think. Technically speaking, all a rat needs is 3 to 4 ounces of food a day, but these rats seem to be greatly exceeding that amount, and wouldn't you? It's not at all difficult to picture the rat eating at its food source until the food source is destroyed, cleaned out, until the rat must move on to the next alley, the next street, the next neighborhood.
That's Robert Sullivan reading from his new book, Rats. Robert, why did you want to spend a year observing rats in a New York alley?
I feel like saying it wasn't my fault. I didn't mean to do it. Sometimes I don't know why at all, and other times it seems I can't believe I wasn't doing it sooner. I like to go places where rats tend to be, and you know, alleys and swamps and garbage dumps, all the places that nobody wants to go to. It turns out that rats are kind of the theme park mascot of my places that I like. But the other thing happened was I was writing a book about a whale hunt, about a tribe, Native American tribe, and they were hunting a whale. And everybody, of course, came up to say you can't hunt a whale. The tribe said we should be able to, maybe. And some people said you should. It was a big to-do about whales. And I started reading about whales and why we kind of love whales. And I read about how we went from being a whaling nation and whaling, you know, the whales out of the world pretty much, to being a nation that kind of loves whales, loves dolphins, especially loves dolphins. And we feel we're on a parallel. Sometimes some people think we can communicate with dolphins, we're like dolphins. And then I started thinking, well, what's the creature that nobody feels like they can think like? The creature that nobody wants to say, I went swimming with rats tonight, you know, and in a lagoon in Florida. And that ends up being rats. So this is the creature that I want to check out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how did you choose your spot to observe rats?
Well, I have a friend from high school, my friend Dave, and we still hang out even since high school, and we decided to kind of go out looking for the perfect place to look for rats. Of course, we asked our wives if it's all right if we went out after dinner to look for rats. And my wife said that would be fine as long as I went with Dave. It's very important to her that I'm with somebody when I'm out there looking at rats. Although, after a while, I was going alone. I got to know my alley. But we just kind of went into downtown Manhattan at night. I'd gotten some tips from some exterminators that around the seaport would be a good area. First, we found this abandoned McDonald's. It was kind of filled with rats. What was amazing was, initially, we looked in the McDonald's. We went by it maybe a couple times that night, or we looked in it at first and saw nothing. But then we went back and we realized it was filled with rats. We just didn't know how to see them. And this is an exciting thing you learned early on, is that there's all this stuff going on in places that you don't know stuff is going on. You can't see rats. That doesn't mean they're not there. Anyway, we ended up going beyond that to this little alley that was kind of between two restaurants. And it was just, we realized, really full of rats. And moreover, there was this great kind of multicultural food supply. And finally, this was just a great small alley that I felt like I'd maybe seen once but hadn't seen. People were walking by it and not noticing it. And that felt like the perfect place, a place that everybody passed by and nobody saw.
Now, rats are nocturnal animals. When do they start coming out?
They come out on cue. It's amazing. They come out right after the sunset, just before it gets dark. They come out first, and they do an initial feeding. As I'm saying this, I can't believe that this really happens, but it really happens. They kind of get an initial, you know, run through. It's sort of like breakfast. Then if it's a heavy alley, an alley with a lot of garbage, you'll see them continue to be out. But sometimes they'll go back into their nests. And in this particular alley, that meant that they would sometimes go back down through the cracks and the cobblestones, back down into the street, into the hill, which was very, very amazing. But anyway, then they'll come out again kind of in the middle of the night, and they'll oftentimes come out for another big feeding before sunset. It's the reverse of our day.
I always associate rats with garbage. Do rats have a preference for food that's rotting? Or if we left, like, fresh food out for them, would they be eating that as much as the garbage?
Well, rats like garbage, but there's different kinds of garbage. And many people think of garbage, rightfully, as garbage. But if you take apart garbage, you see that, there's all different parts to it. And rats won't eat rancid food. They won't go for stale or bad food necessarily. They'll take what they like first. And I think it's written in the rat literature that a rat might starve in an alley full of raw carrots. Rats, generally speaking, are not crazy about their vegetables. They like fried foods. They like fatty foods. A really fun thing about the rat food preference list is that it matched up very nicely with the human food preference list. And,
right.
You know, like a gourmet magazine, I could just see a rat sitting down saying, oh, yeah, I got to make that out of last week's garbage. But a rat could, you know, a rat discerns within garbage. And another interesting thing about rat food and garbage is that rats develop kind of a preference, a palate that matches the neighborhood. And I'd sort of heard this. I'd heard from exterminators who'd said that, my rats like this kind of spicy food and my rats like this kind of food. And it's pretty interesting to think that a rat would develop an interest in the food that matched the culture, the ethnicity that lived in that neighborhood. It's pretty, pretty exciting.
So what was like the creepiest or scariest moment for you when you were in the alley that you adopted observing the rats?
There were many creepy, disturbing moments. But the most sort of rat-oriented, rat-freaky moment definitely happened to be when I was in this one alley with my friend Dave and another friend Matt, and I had to kind of turn away people from going ratting with me. Oftentimes people would say, you know, could I go to your rat alley? And that's the kind of thing, you can't let everybody go to your rat alley. It gets out of hand. So at one point I did, though, bring a second friend when we were thinking about maybe trapping rats and so forth. Something that didn't work out the way I'd hoped. Anyway, Matt and Dave were in the alley, and there was a guy named Derek who was kind of living around the alley, and he seemed to have some control over the rats in this alley. And this was another alley from my alley, but it was definitely a rat-filled alley. And he orchestrated the movement of the rats, Derek did. And Derek began calling upon the rats and beating with a stick and beating metal, and the rats then started running out all at once. And we went over the numbers immediately after Dave and Matt and I went over the numbers, and there were definitely, we want to say thousands of rats, but there weren't. There were somewhere between 100 and 200 rats. There were a lot of rats, and they were all coming down the alley. This is a tough thing to experience if you're just a person in sneakers and light camping gear. And here comes this pack of rats, which, of course, I'd read about, many times but never seen. And the pack of rats is coming. And what was most amazing was as soon as they hit this corner, corner of an old abandoned building, they all took a left. And it was just like watching everybody come off of Lexington Avenue and sneak into that small subway entrance that's around 59th or 58th. Everybody went down a single file. It went from crazed mass pack of rats to single file. Okay, around the corner, we're going down this hole now. It was incredible.
Well, although you were really fascinated to find this alley that was filled with rats every night, it's not a good thing that the city has alleys like that. You were able to find it pretty easily. Do you think, the health department knew about it?
Well, I made a mistake in mentioning one alley that I was kind of thinking about checking out to the health department, which I have to say is a very, very good health department. And very shortly thereafter, there were no more rats in that alley. So I tried to not say anything about the alley that I settled on for my studies just to see what would happen if I didn't interfere with it.
Robert Sullivan speaking to Terry Gross last year. His book called Rats is now out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Robert Sullivan. His book is called Rats. He spent a year, off and on, observing rats in one alley near the former World Trade Center. He also did a lot of research on rats, their behavior, the history of rats, and so on.
I thought of your research studying rats and September 11th as being just, totally unrelated. But after September 11th, a lot of public health researchers were worried that there might be some kind of terrorism through rats, like some spreading of plague, for instance. So exterminating rats actually became a very important part of terrorism prevention after September 11th, and you were able to observe some of that. Can you talk first about what specifically the fears were?
Well, the fears were of the plague, because plague is one of the weapons of choice for bioterrorism, as I understand it, from talking to the CDC and so on, and talking from the New York Health Department. And rats spread the plague. Spreading plague via rats would not be the best way to go about it if you wanted for some crazy reason to do that. There's other ways that you would go about it. But rats once wiped out a huge portion, as many people know, of Europe, like a third of Europe, during the Black Death. It wasn't rats, though. It was the fleas on the rats. So after 9/11, people came in and said, "Well, wait a minute. What's going to happen with rats?" Well, there's a lot of stuff around. There's not going to be a lot of people around. So rats will have. They'll start. The population might explode, and it did. It did explode, except that the city moved in to kind of circle the area with what they call bait stations. So they put out poison all around the World Trade Center to try to stop a huge explosion in the rat population.
Was it effective?
Well, people came in afterwards and said, "Oh, there were rats all around there." The one thing I know is, if they hadn't done what they'd done, there would have been a lot of rats. I mean, I saw in different neighborhoods that there were rats, but they definitely prevented a lot of rats. But an interesting thing, if there's plague in your city and rats were spreading it, then you wouldn't want to necessarily come in and kill the rats. You'd think, okay, we have plague, let's get rid of the rats. But in fact, you would maybe want to keep rats alive and think about a way to get rid of the fleas on the rats. Because if you killed the rats, then the fleas infected with plague would jump off the rats and onto either the next rat or, since you're killing rats, the next warm-blooded mammal it could find. And being a warm-blooded mammal myself, you know, you want to watch out with that. So that was an interesting thing to learn, that if there was plague, you wouldn't necessarily want to kill the rats.
You not only spent a lot of time watching rats on the street, you also did a lot of reading about rats. And, I mean, you learned a lot about rat characteristics. Maybe other people knew this. I did not, about the strength of rats' teeth. Talk about how strong they are and what they can do.
Rats' teeth can bite through metal and concrete. There's a scale called Moore's scale of hardness, and they're a 5-5, and that's better than steel. They can chew through anything. And I know an exterminator for New York City who adds glass to the concrete when he patches holes in buildings.
Why does he do that?
So that the rat can't chew through the concrete. He'll hit glass and it'll irritate his mouth.
Wow. That's really interesting. Is that effective?
It's effective. It works for now.
And what about rat reproduction? Like how frequently do they reproduce? How many rats can one female rat spawn in a month or a year?
Rats, I think a female can have between 4 and 7 litters per year. And I think each litter, you're talking between 8 and 12 in a litter. And I read all kinds of numbers on how many rats there can be if that kind of thing goes on frequently, as it does. And the one thing that always stands out in my head is Hans Zinser, who wrote Rats, Lice, and History, this amazing book about sort of disease and history. He compares the rats' ability to, you know, generate more rats to another species. He compares it to man.
Why?
Because the other species that does a really good job of moving into a place and eating everything up and taking it over and then running out of resources and fighting amongst themselves is humans.
And finally, for somebody who found rats in their home, would a cat be an effective way of keeping the rats in check?
No. Cats can be killed by rats. This is a very important point. You must remember, a cat can eat a juvenile rat, could kill a juvenile rat, could stop you from getting rats. But if you had rats and you put a cat in the room with it, it would be like putting me in the ring with Muhammad Ali.
Well, Robert, now that this book is behind you, I wish you a life without rats.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for talking with us.
I wish you a life without rats as well. Thank you.
Robert Sullivan, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. He's the author of Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. It's now out in paperback. Coming up, Sin City. This is Fresh Air. The 36-year-old Texas-based director Robert Rodriguez first captured attention with his $7,000 feature, El Mariachi, but his commercial breakthrough came with Spy Kids and its sequels. an enthusiastic advocate of digital video, Rodriguez now has teamed up with gritty graphic novelist Frank Miller for Sin City, a hyper-stylized action movie with a cast of well-known stars. David Edelstein has a review.
As a film critic, I have spoken to you over the years of the immorality of the vigilante genre, and I have bemoaned the sadism and righteous torture on display in movies and television in the wake of September 11th. I have also lamented the explosion of the comic book superhero genre. With the notable exceptions of Spider-Man 2 and The Incredibles, these interchangeable action thrillers have been crafted for a generation weaned on Game Boys. Meanwhile, computerized effects have taken cinema further and further from the world that humans actually inhabit. And now comes the latest devolutionary milestone, Sin City, a graphic novel come to life, its sets created entirely inside a computer, and boasting the most relentless display of torture and sadism I've encountered in a mainstream movie. My reaction to Sin City is easily stated. I loved it. Or to put it another way, I really loved it. I loved every gorgeous, sick, disgusting, ravishing, overbaked, blood-spurting, artificial frame of it. Yes, this is a tad hypocritical, but sometimes you think, I'll just go to hell. The movie is co-directed by Frank Miller, who created the Sin City graphic novels, and Robert Rodriguez, who gave up his membership in the Directors Guild of America when it wouldn't let him share a credit with Miller, an admirable gesture, and a canny one, too. In Rodriguez's last film, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, the action was edited in a rhythmless bash-along style, and despite the picture's A-list cast, it was no better than a piece of bloody, direct-to-video junk. Now, Frank Miller has given him a virtuosity transplant. The movie is something to see. It's a study in lustrous black and white, with sudden and breathtaking splashes of crimson, chartreuse, and a particularly nauseating mustard for a demonic incubus psychopath, one of several psychos, in fact. You can barely keep track of them all. Sin City consists of three stories, each narrated by a male protagonist in language more hard-boiled than a six-hour egg. In the first, Bruce Willis plays an aging police detective hunting a serial killer of children. In the next, Mickey Rourke plays Marv, a brutish and cynical barfly, Bukowski on steroids, determined to avenge the murder of a prostitute named Goldie. In the third storyline, Private Eye Clive Owen runs afoul of an abusive, misogynistic thug played by Benicio del Toro, and both wind up in Old Town, where, quote, the ladies are the law, awesomely adept at martial arts and artillery, and wearing battle-ready lingerie, too. The mammoth cast includes Jessica Alba, Brittany Murphy, Rosario Dawson, Nick Stahl, Elijah Wood, Michael Madsen, and Michael Clark Duncan. But it's Mickey Rourke's movie. Yes, Mickey's back. He did some serious self-abuse and also went in for obsessive bodybuilding in the 90s. Since then, he hasn't been the prettiest sight. But as Marv, he wears prosthetics that thicken his features and make his ugliness poetic. And he has the big lug powerhouse magnetism of Robert Mitchum.
Goldie's dead. She was murdered and I was right here when it happened. I've been framed for murder, and the cops are in on it. No reason at all to play it quiet. No reason to play it anyway but my way. Whoever killed you is gonna pay, Goldie.
Open up, police.
I'll be right out.
Marv likes to take his time torturing the bad guys. He almost hates to finish them off. You won't believe this muscle-bound pugilist's final encounter with Elijah Wood as a mute cannibal psycho geek who fights like a weightless dervish. Many of my colleagues think Sin City goes on way too long and that its carnage becomes numbing. Well, if you're going to nitpick. But it's important to say the blood isn't red. It's black or white or yellow, so you register the quantity, but don't have that visceral bleh reaction you get with most gut bucket pictures. Sin City is just distanced enough to be an art object. One car ride sequence, directed by Rodriguez's pal Quentin Tarantino, is a little jewel of camera movement, lighting, and design. Elsewhere, Rodriguez doesn't just transplant Miller's frames, he fetishizes them. The images seem dredged up from the collective unconscious of graphic novel freaks. You can tut-tut over the depravity, or you can welcome Sin City as a must-have coffee table book for your interior torture chamber.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. We'll close with a song you may have heard on a new TV commercial. If you haven't heard more of it, you may not know what a lovely song it is. Here is Blossom Dearie's 1957 recording of They Say It's Spring.
When I was young, I lived in a world of dreams, of moods and myths and illusionary schemes. Though now I'm much more grown up, I fear that I must own up to the fact that I'm in doubt of what the modern cynics shout of. They say it's spring, this feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say, that gave the whole world this crazy, heavenly, hazy hue. I'm a lark on the wing, I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a...
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, An American Life in Poetry, we'll meet poet laureate Ted Kooser. For 25 years, he was an insurance executive, writing before work every day. He's now offering a free-of-charge weekly newspaper column to make verse accessible to all. Join us for the next Fresh Air.